This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, the internet has made it easier than ever for one person to speak to thousands, even millions of other people. But how does that affect our democracy? We'll talk to the author of the new book, Cheap Speech, How Disinformation Poisons Our Politics and How to Cure It. Now, Governor Evers was in La Crosse last week to sign a series of bills related to the synthetic opioid fentanyl after those bills passed in the state legislature. One of them decriminalizes testing strips that help identify the drug in other substances with the goal of preventing further overdoses. Here's Evers speaking last week, just to know that he may sound a bit muffled by a face mask.
While promoting safe and responsible use, we're helping ensure folks to keep themselves and others safe by using testing strips to identify if a substance is laced with fentanyl before even taking it.
We're going to talk about how these laws fit into the larger scope of what the state is doing to try to stem the opioid and overdose crises that have picked up during the pandemic. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How does this story affect you? Have you or someone you know had any experience with opioid addiction or overdose that you would be comfortable sharing with us? Has this become a problem for your community during the pandemic? Do you work with people dealing with opioid addiction? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Dr. Chris Eberlein is an emergency physician with Gunderson Health System, medical director for Tri-State Ambulance, and medical advisor for Region 4 for the Wisconsin Healthcare Coalition. Dr. Eberlein, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, good afternoon. Thanks for having me today.
Before we get into these newest laws, these newest efforts, can you talk about the problem with opioids and overdoses? At least according to national numbers, things seem to be getting worse.
Yeah, we've seen this trend over the course of the pandemic. Unfortunately, it's really hit us pretty hard in the last year and a half. Locally, we were seeing a little bit of improvement right before the pandemic hit, but pandemic didn't really help with anything, as we all know. So that has definitely taken a backward step on our on the numbers that we're seeing and causing us to elevate our response a little bit more.
From what we know, is this a case where more people are addicted to opioids now, or is the bigger problem here with overdoses that we're seeing more very dangerous fentanyl showing up in drugs that people are using?
Yeah, unfortunately, I think it's a little of both. Mm. I think that we did see some more people turn to opiates for self-medicating themselves for depression and issues from the pandemic. And then you couple that with the increase in fentanyl in our communities, which is quite frankly so deadly and dangerous that has really fueled the opioid deaths.
I want to get into these new laws now passed by the legislature, signed by the governor. First, the one we just heard about, testing strips for fentanyl or similar synthetic drugs. They will no longer be considered illegal drug paraphernalia. Can you talk about how this would work in practice?
Sure. So currently, prior to this, there was no legal way that you could test what you had, what you're about to take. To check it for fentanyl. And so it was really, quite frankly, a gamble. And so with the increase in fentanyl in our communities, someone would go out and they would buy a drug. Let's say they were purchasing heroin. If fentanyl was in there, you know, it's 100 to 1,000 times more potent than heroin was. And so they could easily overdose. In addition, if someone was buying like oxycodone pills over on the street. You know, we know there's been a few tragic stories of teenagers purchasing these for a party and then not knowing it was fentanyl and having a fatal overdose. So this would allow someone to actually test that substance for fentanyl and see if fentanyl's in there. And that would hopefully change their usage, either hopefully not use at all, but at least if they were going to continue to use, they would either have someone there available with Narcan and reduce the dose that they were going to use.
And just to really hammer this home, somebody who thinks they're taking the heroin, say that they've taken previously, might have a vision of what kind of dose is safe for them. If there's fentanyl, that just totally throws the scale out of whack and makes that overdose and overdose death much more likely. Do I have that right?
You are absolutely correct.
Now, another law has to do with penalties related to making or distributing fentanyl, in particular, having with the intent of doing either of those things. Do you see this as an important step in law, clarifying, I think, enhancing the penalties for that drug?
Yeah, I think so. It always did surprise me that fentanyl was in a category that wasn't as serious as heroin for law enforcement. And so this evens that playing field. So this puts it at that same category. So there's increasing penalties for manufacturing, dealing, and possession of fentanyl. And so hopefully this would help. This is such an overall difficult problem and so multifaceted that you need so many angles to work on reducing overdose deaths, and law enforcement continues to be one of those areas, and this will support that.
And then the third new piece of legislation, setting up a database for cataloging the use of opioids, as well as methamphetamine, a big problem in many communities as well. How important is this kind of data collection to getting a grip on the problem?
I actually think that this is probably one of them that in the end may be incredibly important. In fact, it may end up being one of the most important, because currently there's not a good tracking system to know if they're supposed, so let's say we typically in La Crosse see our overdoses increase 1 to 2 weeks after Milwaukee's. And so there's not a great mechanism for me to be able to track that currently. And this real-time database with analytics would help us to start to see trends across the state and hopefully have more ability to do some preventive measures through public health to hopefully cut these off and eliminate the overdose deaths from that angle as well. And so, it will include methamphetamines, which is good because we continue to see that in our toxicology reports from those that have died from overdoses. That has been an ongoing issue. It doesn't get always as much press because sometimes it's a secondary drug, but it is still a problem as well. So it's nice to see that's in there too.
Talking to Dr. Chris Eberlein, emergency physician at Gunderson Health System, looking at the opioid epidemic, fentanyl overdoses, some new laws in the state trying to help turn the tide on that. Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Brooke is with us in Eau Claire. Brooke, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to tell us about?
So I really wanted to touch base on having treatment centers talk about post-acute withdrawal syndrome and what methadone actually does for patients. I have a significant other who has recently stopped taking methadone and had to go back on from dealing with post-acute withdrawal syndrome. And I feel like methadone and Suboxone are totally different, and we don't warn the patients about the difference in these substances and how their body and mind get so addicted to it. And post-acute withdrawal syndrome is not talked about at all for addiction.
Brooke, thanks a lot for calling in. Best to your acquaintance who's dealing with this. Dr. Eberlein, can you talk about methadone and Suboxone in treatment and concerns, as Brooke was saying, about what happens if and when you stop those?
Yeah, these drugs are always need to be closely monitored and part of a program for opiate addiction and treatment. I by no means am an expert in the treatment of long-term treatment of opiate use disorder as an ER physician, but we do treat the acute withdrawal with buprenorphine in the ER. And methadone, it's a very, very long-acting opiate. And so how they use that is you get a daily dose, and they can slowly titrate you off that. But clearly, if the dosing is not correct, or if the titration is too fast, people will go into a withdrawal syndrome. And so that's why it's so important with any of these drugs to really work closely with your healthcare provider to get that the formulation correct and the treatment you need correct. This is not a one size fits all for every patient. And that is why that communication and working with your physician is just so important with this, because there are many layers to this, not only mental health, but the physical addiction and dependency. So for all those that are struggling with addiction, continue to work with your healthcare providers. They're getting more tools and better understanding all the time.
Brooke. Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Dr. Eberlein, when you've treated that patient who comes in that acute crisis moment after an overdose, they survive, hopefully. Do you have any confidence that they're going to be able to get the kind of services they need, whether that's methadone, Suboxone, the mental health care you were mentioning, and so on?
It's always a challenge. And we've been expanding treatment availability throughout the state over the last several years. Are we to the point where we need to be yet? Absolutely not. We've seen a steady increase in the need for mental health services. How much of that had to do with the pandemic? It's hard to tell yet, but we are clearly in need of ongoing mental health resources throughout, not just our state, but nationwide. This is not an isolated issue, and we are going to continue to need increased capacity in these areas.
We're talking to Dr. Chris Eberlein, emergency physician with Gunderson Health System. We're looking at the fight against opioid overdoses in Wisconsin. Three bills passed the legislature, signed by the governor, that target fentanyl in particular. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have thoughts on those new laws, questions about how they work? Is this part of your life right now? Have you dealt with addiction, or maybe someone close to you worried about overdoses, worried about the presence of fentanyl and other synthetic opioid drugs showing up in local supplies? Or do you work on the healthcare side of things, or are you a first responder? What kind of things are you seeing in your community? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our talk with Dr. Chris Eberlein, emergency physician with Gunderson Health System, medical director for Tri-State Ambulance, and medical advisor for Region 4 for the Wisconsin Healthcare Coalition. We're talking about three new laws that Governor Evers signed, passed by the legislature, aimed at reducing the deadly influence of the synthetic opioid fentanyl and similar drugs here in Wisconsin and the wider opioid crisis. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions, maybe your personal experience. Let's go back to your calls now. Jason is with us in Beaver Dam. Jason, hi.
Hi, sir. I was just calling to say that I've had three back surgeries, 2005, 2010, 2016, and I was on very heavy medication from the doctors, and then I was put on methadone. I was on methadone for almost 10 years, and at the maximum, I was up to 270 milligrams a day. I got off on my, I quit on my own. I weaned myself down until I thought I could quit. And when I finally got off of it, I barely slept for almost, it was a couple months.
Wow.
I barely slept. And by the time I regained that ability to sleep, I still never felt right. And it was about a year and a half later, just recently, a few months ago, I went on Suboxone because I still couldn't feel normal. And it's like you're feeding your body something artificial for so long that it stops producing it naturally. And I guess if I had a question, it would be, does your body ever start to regain that after so many years?
Jason, thanks for the call. Thanks for sharing that. Good luck to you as you are still dealing with this. Dr. Eberlein, you mentioned you're not an expert in this stage of the opioid problem, but what thoughts do you have for Jason and his story?
Yeah, sure. My thoughts are with him. Chronic pain is so difficult to treat, and we are still learning a lot about the impact of these drugs long-term on the body and on the receptors. Thought is that eventually these receptors can recover. Obviously, it's going to be different for everyone, but the thought and hope is that eventually we can get people back to their baseline and back to a normal state. And hopefully with his Suboxone use now that he can continue to function and do well.
Jason, thanks a lot for calling in. Good luck to you. We'll go to Gene now in Stevens Point. Gene, hi.
Hi, I have a question. I'm wondering why the people who are selling these drugs are choosing to cut their drugs with fentanyl. Because it's such a powerful drug, I would think it would be more expensive. Is it easier for them to get their hands on, or what is the reason that they're choosing to use the fentanyl to cut?
Gene, thanks for the call. As I understand it, one reason, Dr. Eberlein, that these synthetic opioids are big is because they're synthetic. There doesn't need to be a crop involved in it. Can you talk about why this stuff is showing up in drug supplies?
For sure. I think it's purely economics. You know, she brings up a very good point, because on the surface, you'd think that this may hurt your business and it would be more difficult, but it's actually the opposite. Now, with heroin, you need a whole poppy field, and it's very easily noticed by satellites, law enforcement. They can destroy these fields. What we've seen is a shift from heroin to fentanyl because, as you mentioned, you make these in a lab, so they can mass produce this drug, often overseas. And then when you think about the need and difficulty of smuggling a substance in, so if you've got something that's up to 1,000 times more potent, that's 1,000 times less volume you have to smuggle into the country. And so it makes all aspects of this drug trade easier. The manufacturing is simpler because you don't have the crops, and the actual distribution of it is simpler because it's a much smaller quantity that you need to move.
Gene, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking about opioid drugs, especially synthetic opioids like fentanyl, with Dr. Chris Eberlein from Gunderson Health System, emergency physician there. Still time for your calls with your questions, maybe your experiences, at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Eberlein, her question reminds me why we had fentanyl in the first place. My understanding is there was a legitimate use for it originally, mainly for people in extreme pain with things, for example, like a very advanced forms of cancer.
Yeah, and you know, this is a drug that is very commonly used in the healthcare setting because it actually has a great, when you're monitored appropriately and you know exactly the dose that you're giving, such as in a hospital, it is a fantastic drug for acute pain. We use it in trauma, we use it in surgery, areas that you are in extreme, that you would be in extreme pain otherwise. So these are the areas that we use it in. And so it's a great tool in a physician and surgeon anesthesiologist toolbox. But in the setting, when you're not monitored, you don't know the dose, it is incredibly dangerous just because of its potency.
Let's go back to our callers now. Bill is with us calling from the North Woods. Bill, hi.
Hi. Thank you so much. What a remarkable topic. Yeah, it's something that on the other side of the scale, that there's the over-policing, basically, of the people that are in chronic pain that need, you know, pain medication to help them, can't get it, and they're into like a palliative care situation, that there's basically physicians, and the new pain route is doing epidural injections because they're making thousands of dollars per treatment versus writing out a prescription. And it's really just not fair, because people are so desperate, that's what they're doing. That's why I feel the overdoses are high, because they are hitting the streets because they can't get anything for pain.
Bill, thanks for sharing that. An important perspective, Dr. Eberlein, concerned that people who do need opioid medications, now there's a reluctance to prescribe them.
Yeah, and this is something that I think we've been trying to be very careful about, is that you continue to treat people's pain. And recently the CDC loosened up a little bit some of the recommendations on the draft that I saw, some of the wording on prescription opioids. You still need to treat pain there are some people that are going to need pain medications to treat their pain. So clearly we have to make sure that the pendulum doesn't swing so far that we're not treating patients appropriately. What we really need to do is find that middle ground where patients are getting their pain treated and hopefully the cause of their pain treated, because the reality is the pain medication isn't fixing anything. It's covering up something that is wrong in the body. And so if we can get to the point where we can actually fix the problem, whether that be with physical therapy, acupuncture. I mean, there's lots of other modalities to treat pain. Yeah, that's ideal, but you will have some patients that will need opiate pain medications to function. And that's the conversation that with your pain specialist and your doctor, that's really important to have. So that way, by no means we want people to suffer.
Bill, thanks a lot for that call. Dr. Eberlein, you're an emergency room physician. You see people coming in with these overdose crises. What, in your mind, would be the biggest help for you, whether that's resources or changes in state or federal law or fill in the blank? What would help you do your job?
Yeah, you know, we've made steady progress on this over the last few years. This new set of bills will be helpful. I'm really looking forward to the database to be able to know what's in the community, when the spikes are coming, that could alter our response on EMS as well. So that real-time data will be very helpful. Continuing to treat this complex problem with treatment programs, ongoing Narcan availability. You know, it's always a concern of mine. You know, a lot of the Narcan that's out in our communities that's saving lives every day is dependent on government grants, like the Narcan Direct program. If that money went away, it would be a huge impact, and I think we'd see a massive spike in overdose deaths because people aren't going to go out and spend $80 for a pack of Narcan. Education, this is not a, there's not one single fix to this. We really need this comprehensive plan. And I think we're starting to hit more angles on it. And hopefully in the next few years, we continue to see improvement. This was a long time coming and this problem built up over years. It's going to take years to correct it as well.
We'll leave it there. Dr. Eberlein, thanks again for joining us today.
You're very welcome. Anytime.
Dr. Chris Eberlein is an emergency physician with Gunderson Health System. He joined us today for a look at Wisconsin's fight against opioid abuse and overdoses and how a trio of new laws targeting fentanyl in particular fit into that overall effort. Want to remind anyone who might be looking for substance use treatment and recovery services, you can dial 211 for the Wisconsin Addiction Recovery Helpline. That's free. It's available 24/7. Again, that number, 211 for the Wisconsin Addiction Recovery Helpline. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, housing prices have gone up in many places around Wisconsin. That's making it hard for people to live in the communities where they work. Can find out about a new statewide effort to boost workforce housing around Wisconsin. You can join in with your story. Start right now. Email ideas@wpr.org. That conversation's coming up tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. What's cool? The Northern Lights, as we learned yesterday on the show. We found out the best ways to have a chance of seeing the Northern Lights, aka Aurora Borealis, here in Wisconsin. What happens when you shoot some rockets through the Northern Lights? Well, we might find out tomorrow. NASA is planning to launch a couple of rockets tomorrow night to fly through the Northern Lights. On the one hand, this sounds like the kind of science experiment I might have come up with back in junior high. But there is some actual science going on here. They're trying to figure out how the aurora interacts with Earth's atmosphere. The rockets are going to have lots of sensors that track what's going on in the Northern Lights, temperature, density, the basics, plus they'll leave a vapor path to show which way the wind is blowing. Are we going to see footage live or recorded? I hope so. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. If you wanted to speak to a lot of people 40 years ago, there were some hurdles. You'd have to come up with the funds to put an ad on the TV or on a billboard, or you'd need the connections to get a column posted in the newspaper. Today, the internet has made spreading our thoughts and ideas across the world easier than ever. Our next guest says that's had a complicated effect on our democracy, especially in a time of disinformation and misinformation. We're talking about speech, the internet, and how they affect American politics, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you see misinformation showing up in your own social media feed? Are you worried about how it spreads, how it affects our politics? Do you hesitate before sharing a story or before believing a story that you see online? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Rick Hassan is the Chancellor's Professor of Law and Political Science at the University of California, Irvine. He's co-director of the Fair Elections and Free Speech Center. His latest book is called Cheap Speech: How Disinformation Poisons Our Politics and How to Cure It. Rick, welcome back to Central Time.
It's great to be back with you.
It's a borrowed phrase. What do you mean by cheap speech?
Right, it is a borrowed phrase. It comes from a law review article that was written in the Yale Law Journal back in 1995 by a professor named Eugene Volokh at UCLA Law School. And he was predicting the upcoming internet social media revolution. He's writing before all of the rise of things like Spotify and Netflix, and thought this was going to be just a mostly good development for American democracy. Getting rid of intermediaries meant you could get information very easily. We'd go from kind of a trickle of information to a flood of information. And he thought that people would do pretty well without having intermediaries like the local newspaper figure out what's worth hearing, what is truth and what is justified. And, you know, so he meant cheap speech, that it's inexpensive. In my book, Cheap Speech, written now in 2022, I see a dark side to this. It's very expensive to produce quality journalism. The economic market for producing newspapers has changed. Journalists have lost jobs faster than coal miners because classified advertising and other kinds of advertising, just you don't need to use newspapers for that anymore. Still very expensive to produce quality information, but very cheap to produce fake information. And so we have kind of a problem with the marketplace of ideas in that the disinformation crowds out the true information. Voters throw up their hands. They don't want to pay for the true information. Some voters even have developed a taste for disinformation when it confirms what they really believe. So it really is, as you said at the top, a complicated relationship with our democracy and information.
You opened the book with a case study, pretty well known now. You had worried that then-President Trump wouldn't accept an election loss. You were worried about this way before the 2020 election. He lost the election, and yet here we are still in 2022 with former President Trump and others still contesting the election loss. Can you talk about the flow of that misinformation and how it fits into your concept of cheap speech?
Sure. So one of the claims I make in the book is that if we had the same polarized politics of today, but the technology of the 1950s, we wouldn't be in the same democracy mess that we are in right now. So if you think about the fact that millions of people now believe the false claim that the 2020 election was stolen, and I've studied the election very carefully, and I've been studying elections for a very long time, I don't believe there's any reliable evidence that the 2020 election was stolen. But Donald Trump was able to go, just looking at his Twitter feed, over 400 times between November 3rd and November 21st to make false and exaggerated and vitriolic claims about the election being stolen. I think he inspired the events of January 6th by directly going to voters, telling them to stop the steal and to come to D.C. for a wild time. People organized on Facebook groups, we know this, to participate in some of it illegal actions. If we were back in the technology of the 1950s, the local newspaper, the local radio station, the New York Times would not be 400 times repeating Trump's false claims and giving them amplification. It is a kind of information environment where demagogues can flourish and where misinformation, especially when it makes people feel better about their situation, whether that's economically or politically, there's a demand for it. So there's a supply that is supplied for political reasons and sometimes for financial reasons. A lot of people have gotten rich off the Stop the Steal movement, and the supply fuels more demand for ever more outlandish explanations for how we got into the predicament we're in today.
Talking to Rick Hassan about his new book, Cheap Speech, How Disinformation Poisons Our Politics and How to Cure It. You can join in at 800-642-1234. One consequence, Rick, of a lot of misinformation is people might believe it. You point toward another consequence, though. I'm going to quote here from your book. Bad information is driving out good, and voters discount all information as potentially unreliable, end quote. So it might be persuading some people to believe things that aren't true. It might persuade other people, misinformation, to just give up.
Sure. And, let me give an example of this. About maybe 2 weeks ago, the Washington Post ran a story about an upcoming documentary about Roger Stone. Roger Stone, one of the kind of President Trump's allies, a longtime political dirty trickster, who's recorded on video doing some things that indicate he had far more involvement in the events of January 6th than he has led on to. And after this story broke, Roger Stone said, no, these were deep fakes. These were false videos making me look bad. And there's no reason to believe that these were fake videos, but yet in an environment where there's so much fake information floating out there, you have what Professors Chesney and Citron have called the liar's dividend. It's easier to claim true information is false, to claim everything is fake news. Trump liked to call all bad news against him fake news. And you're right, voters sometimes will just throw up their hands and say, I can't trust anything. And then that's not good for democracy, because we want voters to be able to get reliable information so they can make voting choices consistent with their values and their interests.
Before we go to our callers, Rick, you spend most of your book looking at possible solutions. I want to touch on a little bit of that here. You look at potential, first of all, legal changes related to misinformation. You dismiss some of them as being potential violations of our free speech. As you sort through possible legal remedies, what stand out to you as the most promising avenues?
Well, so let's start off by saying that we should have a commitment both to a democracy where voters can get reliable information to make those sensible decisions, but also one that's committed to free speech, which is protected by the First Amendment. And you know, any democracy needs to have lots of breathing room for people to say things that might be controversial so voters can make their choices. But how do you balance these things? And so some people think, hearing me talk about the problems of cheap speech, that I'm calling for censorship. And really, I'm not. I don't think, other than some very narrow areas like foreign spending, or when people lie about when election day is, or if you can vote by text, and we've had examples of that, I don't favor limiting speech. What I favor is other kinds of laws that help to make better decisions. So, for example, talked about those deep fakes. These are these audios or videos that can be use artificial intelligence to make it look like a politician is doing something embarrassing or having some kind of health crisis. I want all of those videos labeled as altered. That way, a voter will know, is this something that I can believe? Can I believe my own eyes? Can I believe my own ears? And so labeling or disclosure is a way to deal with the problem that that people don't necessarily know what's true. And we had a situation in 2016 where the Russian government was using agents to pose as African-American voters and say, don't vote for Hillary Clinton, don't show up to vote at all. I think those voters would have liked to know that those were not actually African-American voters who were making these claims, but Russian government workers. So we need improved disclosure laws when it comes to attempts to influence our elections. That's the kind of thing I think we need. It's not going to solve all our problems. Law is only a partial solution, but I think it is an important part of the package of what we need.
Talking to Rick Hassan, co-director of the Fair Elections and Free Speech Center at the University of California, Irvine. He's with us today to talk about his latest book, Cheap Speech, How Disinformation Poisons Our Politics and How to Cure It. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see more local news produced in your community? Do you miss a local newspaper? Do you see people in your network sharing misinformation? Did you see that during the 2020 election, say? Do you think Facebook, Twitter, other social media providers should be more aggressive about limiting misinformation? If so, how? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk with election law expert Rick Hassan about his latest book, Cheap Speech, How Disinformation Poisons Our Politics and How to Cure It. Let's go to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Jeff is with us in Superior. Hi, Jeff.
Hello, gentlemen. Great topic. I wanted to tell you, when I was a teenager, I was a paperboy. I used to deliver the Superior Evening Telegram. It was a daily. And when Nixon resigned and the Fitzgerald sank, I had people coming up to me on my bike, buying my paper for a dollar. Just give me a copy, you know? And as I got older, I continued with the assumption that people wanted to know the news. But I'm 60 years old now, and I don't think people really want to know. In fact, I think one of the cool things about fake news and misinformation is it's kind of entertaining. Like, who would say something crazy like what we've heard? So to the point now where I don't even have a TV, I don't watch the news, and, you know, I just live my life, and everything seems to be fine.
Jeff, thanks for the call. Rick, do we want to know the news? Can we handle the news?
Well, I think it's interesting that the person called and said they're not listening to the news, but they're obviously listening to your program, or they wouldn't be calling in. I mean, I think people still get the news. I think there is a small subset of society that is not going to be swayed by listening to the news, but there's a much larger part of society that is looking for truthful and reliable information, even if they get it incidentally, even if they see, you know, a headline as they're walking down the street and see a newspaper, or they're turning the dial, or they're watching a sports program and they get a headline. So I think, you know, there's a lot of fatigue out there now, given the polarization of our politics, especially in a place like Wisconsin, where things have gotten so ugly. I think there's a tendency to want to withdraw. But we really do, as a democracy, need to have engaged citizens, and engaged citizens who can tell truth from falsity. And that's the kind of thing that I'm concerned about in the book.
Thanks for the call, Jeff. We'll go next to Jay on the line in Madison. Jay, hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Jay?
I wanted to ask yeah, Rick, kind of about the difference between newspaper and television media. I know that, like, newspapers have op-ed sections where it's very clearly distinguished when opinions are being presented versus just news and factual information. I think a lot of the frustration with television media is it seems like 90% of it is opinion pieces anymore. And a lot of people I've heard, conservatives and liberals, will talk about the good old days when the news was just the news.
Jay, thanks. Blurry lines on TV news in particular, Rick, where people don't know if they're getting a news or an opinion bit.
Right. Well, you know, so the issue today is that there is just a flood of information, and good information and bad information, fact and opinion. It's the same thing if you go onto Facebook or Twitter. Some things are going to be true, some things are going to be false, some things are going to be opinion. So this does raise the, you know, what I talk about in the last part of the book, the kind of non-law related ways of trying to deal with this. And one of those is digital literacy, figuring out how you can give people the tools to be able to tell the difference between news and opinion. And I think it's very important for stations like MSNBC or Fox or CNN to make it very clear when something is news and when it is opinion. And, you know, right now we know that CNN is going to have a new owner, and the talk is that the all the opinion shows that appear in the evening, there's going to be more of a pushback towards straight news. One of the reasons that we don't see straight news in the evenings on any of these programs is because opinion is what sells. People want to hear what is going to reinforce their existing beliefs. So it might be that the economic incentive is to produce opinion rather than news, and that's unfortunate.
Thanks for the call. We're talking to Rick Hassan about his new book, Cheap Speech, How Disinformation Poisons Our Politics and How to Cure It. Before we go back to our callers, Rick, I wanted to talk about, you mentioned non-legal ways to tackle the problem. You are looking to the Facebooks and Twitters of the world, the social media platforms, to make some changes, and maybe for the public to put pressure on them to make those changes. What kind of things would be most useful, do you think?
Well, so let's start off by pointing out that Facebook and Twitter, just like Fox News or the New York Times, are private entities. So they're not subject to the First Amendment the way the government is, right? So Facebook all the time decides not to include speech. It says, you know what? We're not going to publish hate speech. We're not going to publish pornography. If they didn't do that, these platforms would be much less pleasant and people wouldn't use them. But a government couldn't do that. A government couldn't say, you know, no hateful speech, right? So if they are private entities, how should we deal with them? They are very powerful. I do think that public pressure, for example, on whether or not to deplatform a candidate, that's a decision that the platform should make. But if people don't like the inclusion or the exclusion of Donald Trump, they should make their views known about that issue. Somewhat troublingly, Justice Clarence Thomas of the United States Supreme Court suggested an opinion last year that he thinks it would be constitutional to have a law that forces social media companies to carry the speech of politicians that they don't want to carry, even someone who might falsely claim that elections are being stolen or who might advocate for political violence. And I think that's not the way to go. I think these should be voluntary decisions. I don't think a state should have the availability to something like Facebook or Twitter, a social media company, to carry speech than they could force Fox News or the New York Times to carry such speech. We already have precedents from the Supreme Court that TV stations and newspapers can't be forced to do that.
Let's go back to our callers now. Jim is with us in Dubuque, Iowa. Jim, hi.
Hi. Well, I think we've got developed a problem over a few decades where there's been a consolidation of media to the extent that they're controlled by a handful of corporate entities. And that gives them tremendous power to shape the agenda and the information that people are able to, you know, acquire without some other effort. And even especially a big problem nowadays is censorship, where you can declare a factual statement, any factual statement practically, a hate speech.
Jim, thanks for the call. Rick, he's worried about, first of all, about too much concentrated control of media, I think including local media. Do you see that as part of the problem?
Well, so to the extent that there is media concentration, I think that the solution to that, whether that's social media or more traditional media, I think the solution to that is antitrust. That is, you know, if we think a search company like Google has too much power and could sway how elections are run, then we need to figure out how to give them less power. We can't have a law that says you must be even-handed, because I really wouldn't trust a government bureaucrat to be able to do that. I mean, think of the president you like the least and imagine that he or she has the ability to just decide what's unfair, right? And so I don't think we'd want that. So the way to deal with problems of media concentration, if they arise, is through breaking up those companies and then letting there be competition. Something like Facebook, it's not a monopoly, but it does have an advantage in that it there are network effects. So you only want to go on Facebook if a lot of your friends are there. You know, there is a question about how you break up Facebook. But one thing I'd point out is that Meta, the company that now owns Facebook, also owns Instagram and WhatsApp. And it's not clear that that's a good model. Think about Google. It's not just search, right? It's advertising and lots of other things. YouTube, for example, owned by Google. So we might want to think about breaking up these larger companies to have more competition. And then we don't have to worry about any particular company doing something that is going to really have an oversized influence over our politics.
I want to get into something that you've touched on already. It's a recurring theme in your book, the decline of local media in particular, and it's how it is part of what you see as poisoning our politics. Why is local media such an important part of your story? How could we bring it back?
So we do know that local media is what is most trusted by voters for providing accurate information. And unfortunately, local newspapers have been decimated, right? They've been bought out by venture capital firms that have sold off their assets. You know, I think the Des Moines Register, I think I read a figure that they had 100 people covering state politics. And now they have 3. I mean, just really, it's not out there. And this leaves room for fake websites that purport to be providing news but are really providing propaganda. And we've seen Democrats and Republicans and even the Russian government try to create these local news sites to fill that void. And so I suggest that there are basically, a couple of models to deal with this. One is to provide subsidies, right? We've got government subsidies, but another is the donation model, right? That's kind of how public radio works. It's also how things like the Texas Tribune or the Nevada Independent work, right? These are focused on particular states, but they provide deep investigative reporting. The other thing I suggest is that media companies set up, not media companies, excuse me, journalistic groups set up codes of conduct. This is what it means to be a legitimate journalist. You get two sources before you make a claim. You try to get a response from someone that you're writing about. And then there could be a seal of approval, voluntary seal of approval that goes on media companies. And that could be used on social media so people know, oh, it's from Wisconsin Public Radio. They can be trusted because they abide by these characteristics. And I think that would be a way to give another signal to voters as to what is valuable information for them.
We'll leave it there. Rick, thanks again for joining us today.
It's been a pleasure.
That's Rick Hassan, Chancellor's Professor of Law and Political Science at the University of California, Irvine, co-director of the Fair Elections and Free Speech Center. He joins us today to talk about his latest book. It's called Cheap Speech, How Disinformation Poisons Our Politics and How to Cure It. If you have an example of disinformation you've run into maybe lately, let us know about it. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, do you have a good idea? Do you want to make it a big idea? A Wisconsin author tells us how to take those little inspirations and put them to work for a whole business, a community, or the whole world. And we'll meet a Wisconsin cross-country skier who's participated in every Birkebeiner race since 1973. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, we'll look at a bill in Congress that would delist wolves in the Great Lakes region from the endangered species list and what that would mean for us here in Wisconsin. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.